This is the summer where women's football jumps into the limelight like never before. It's a summer that could have a game-changing effect on women's sport in general, and the 2019 FIFA World Cup in France has a huge part to play, provided everyone gets it right. On this latest FIFA World Cup special episode, we're going to look at the bigger picture, the influences, the inspiration, and the changes that need to be made in society right here in the UK. From social media to the players on the pitch, this could be the pioneering World Cup we have been crying out for. Hello listeners, and thank you for tuning in to our latest FIFA World Cup special episode here on Sportspiel. Doing the talking here today is myself, as always, and my co-host Will Moulton. You getting excited for the tournament starting?
Buzzing. Cannot wait. It's going to be epic.
Not long to go as well. June the 7th is the start date for the tournament, and as we count down, we do still have plenty to talk about. First, we're going to look at the social and social media aspect before we turn the spotlight onto participation levels across the nation and what is changing. Social media has a big part to play at this tournament. The announcement of the Lionesses squad by 23 different celebrities was a crucial move, and Germany's video, where they proclaimed how they didn't have balls but knew how to use them, was a wonderfully executed two-finger salute at the dinosaurs that still lurk in the social media doldrums. So I begin our chat with, have we seen the social media professionalism take off, and how will that actually make a difference to the way the tournament is received and picked up?
Well, first of all, with what the Lionesses did, it's opened up the possibility of an entirely new audience following the sport. With so many big names announcing the squad comes so many loyal fans who will follow and do everything they're told to by these celebrities. So if they've told them to go and watch Steph Horton, Fran Kirby, Jade Moore in this World Cup, because this celebrity has said it, these fans will do it, and most of them probably wouldn't have had an interest in women's football before. So clever what they did. And as someone who works in elite sport comms, really annoying that they thought of it before we did. But I remember watching it thinking, this is brilliant.
Likewise, it was very well received, as it should have been. And it's not really, it's not just the only example, I think, of social media changing in respect to this tournament. The BBC trailer for their coverage, because they're showing every World Cup game, which is a big move in itself, but I presume you've seen the video that's got, it's got the song, it's got the fire, it has the word rise in it, it's got Ada Hegerberg's shirt in it. There's so many messages within that 60-second clip, and it's one of those clips that instantly grabs the audience, I think.
Absolutely. And again, it's another example of them taking this tournament seriously. But what needs to happen now is that we've had this fantastic start on social media, people talking about it. As we speak now, the BBC are actually doing a really strong Women in Sport Week, where you look on the homepage and there's so much female sport being talked about, which is fantastic. And they're doing a countdown to the World Cup every day, sort of 20 days to go. They're doing goals like they would for a men's football World Cup. What that needs to happen now is this needs to continue throughout the tournament. It's a long tournament, 4 or 5 weeks. The momentum can't drop. England and the BBC and a lot of people have set themselves a really high precedent in terms of social media coverage, and they've got to continue to keep improving this, because otherwise people are going to stop being bothered. And even if the Lionesses are winning, if the coverage isn't there backing that up, the momentum will drop. So it's an important start, but they've also left themselves with a lot of work they need to do in order to keep this going.
One of my big notes that I've written down is the tone of the coverage, which I think is quite a lot different to how it has been in the past. The sentence I've written down is, it's badass and not belittling. Because off the top of my head, I look back to 2017, and do we remember the FA's Disney Princess campaign where they tried to get girls playing football?
Yeah, I vaguely remember that. It wasn't a good idea.
Horrendous backlash because the whole princess, Disney princess ideal was predominantly the reason girls didn't go into football in the first place. So that's why I enjoyed their social media campaign, why I enjoyed the BBC trailer, because it was badass and you're not treating girls like Disney princesses the entirety of the time. They want to be fine. But I know there's a lot of girls who don't really fit into that bracket. So in terms of the tone, how important is it we get that tone right and don't, while having well-meaning thoughts, essentially belittle the game?
I think that is very crucial. And I think so far the FA and the team behind the social media account have got that spot on. One thing you notice, the difference between this squad announcement and the squad announcement for the Men's World Cup last year. The Men's World Cup last year was done by kids and it was highlighting a diversity and an ethnic background to the sport, which was great. This was actually putting the female players on a pedestal, but also they felt the need to use celebrities in order to get more people interested. And they've recognised that the women's team still didn't have the same level of following and have tried to do something about it. But rather than belittling it, they've actually made it cool and accessible to so many more people. So they've started off really well. But as I said before, they need to keep that going.
Long
and need
continue.
To stop. Or they clearly have moved away from the mistakes of 2 years ago. The way the Lionesses are treated now is so much different, so much better than it was before. So it looks promising. But yes, I agree, the tone has to be right throughout the tournament. And it's such a difficult thing to do. I know from personal experience, it's different in hockey because the women have always been seen as equal, if not slightly more well known than the men. Whereas football is very stereotypically men are better than women, which isn't the case. Men are different to women, and that is what. And they've just got to strike the balance right. And so far, so good.
As someone who is obviously working in the sports comms world, and as someone who is as invested in women's sport as you are, what with the 52 blog and all that, in terms of the trolling and the stereotypical views that keep getting spouted on Twitter, is there a marked difference to how it was in the past? Is it improving, or do you notice any difference whatsoever?
I think the more women's sport is talked about, the more of these comments are coming through, unfortunately.
Was it more reactionary than anything else?
Just men thinking they're funny. Basically, I mean, we're talking a few days after there was a video released. It's on a different topic, but on periods in sport. And the BBC did a great interview with two of our athletes, Giselle Ansley and Sarah Jones. I thought it was brilliant, really highlighting, you know, something that we don't know a lot about, let's be honest. And some of the comments under that from men were awful. And I didn't notice it so much on the day of the squad announcement, but on subsequent articles when people have been talking about the World Cup, there's just been men just belittling it. But what's been good to see is there's also an abundance of men and women who are also fighting back against these comments, which is something you wouldn't get before. It would just be comment after comment of just men being... I can't say that word I was about to say because this is being broadcast live, but men being idiots and thinking they're funny and belittling women and being sexist and all sorts. Whereas now, there are more of these comments because of the increased coverage, but there are also many more people fighting back, which is brilliant.
Wait, is that the key then? Because I suppose people try and focus on how do you stop the negative comments coming, but can you really stop the negative comments coming?
Absolutely not.
Is it a lot better when you've got a whole load more supportive comments balancing it out, essentially?
Yeah, you're never gonna stop the negative comments. You just need to. It's a difficult one. Do you ignore them? Do you respond to them? What do you do? There's no right and wrong answer. But the FA, the BBC with their coverage, other media outlets with their coverage, and the people invested and involved in it, if they do the talking, their voices will be the ones that get heard, and not the ones of these trolls.
Interestingly, on the trolling front, this week, we, in my role as a local news journalist, we were advised on how to respond to certain levels of abuse on social media. Whether it was, you know, they sort of categorized them in different levels, whether it was just mean words, criticizing your profession, criticizing the way you've written an article, then it's okay to handle it how you see fit, so long as it's polite and so long as it's professional. But then there's obviously the other tiers that you have to come into, where it can be death threats, can be something way more serious. Think back to what Karen Carney had a few months ago, where she got the rape threats on Instagram. So I suppose it's still being wary about how that social media abuse can really take on a whole new monster, if you like, of its own, because it is still possible.
Absolutely. It's slightly different for me because I'm not getting abused directly. It's the company that's largely taking the abuse. And to be honest, what we get in hockey isn't worthy of a response, to be honest. It's just one of those, they're just trying to wind us up. Whereas, we're quite lucky in the abuse we get isn't particularly serious, and it's largely just juvenile comments or just people airing their opinion. Whereas, for something like football, some of the comments you read through are just unbelievable how people can think like that. But just the more we keep talking about women's sport, the more it becomes normalised, the better the players do. Eventually, they will get drowned out. And will they ever stop? Probably not, but hopefully they'll just won't feel the need to be as vile publicly.
Interestingly, we did once find a Twitter account that had been set up specifically to troll our publication and our reporters. So we all kept getting a few retweets here and there with various captions on them. And whoever was running that called me a nerd several times, to which I took great offence to.
How dare they?
I know. Moving on back to the players' side of things, and one of the bigger talking points, if you like, from this tournament is the fact that the world's best player right now, in Ada Hegerberg, is not there, despite the fact that her country, Norway, are there. Obviously, I think it's very well known her stand on this, and that she's choosing not to represent her country due to the mounting frustrations that she has with the way women's football and the players are being treated in Norway. But this, bear in mind, this is a player who won the first Ballon d'Or. She recently got crowned BBC Footballer of the Year as well, and also scored a hat-trick in the Champions League final. So the accolades keep on coming, bearing in mind she's 23 as well, so there's still so much football left in her. But one of the interesting debates is, considering her stance and the way she's airing her views, is it a good thing or not having her at that competition? Because if you look at it from a fan standpoint, it's obviously a disappointment. But then if you look at it from maybe how the game will develop in the near future, will we actually look back and think her stance was for the greater good?
Given the potential importance of this tournament in terms of shaping the future of not just women's football, but women's sport, it is disappointing she's not going to be there. Imagine you've come home from work, or your kids have come home from school, and they're flicking on the TV and they flick on to see Norway versus South Korea, as an example. I don't know if they're in the same group, but and then you just happen to flick over and see Ada Hegerberg produce a moment of absolute quality, which we all know she's capable of. That could just, like that, just click someone and make them interested in women's sport. So to have her not there, not because the team hasn't qualified, but because of she's refusing to play, it could be detrimental. But at the same time, if her stance works and she gets what she wants from the Norwegian board, that could also be a huge momentum changer for all countries, because then other players will think, well, she's managed to achieve that, we want the same thing. We could see, from our perspective, the likes of Lucy Bronze doing something like that, from Brazil, Formiga or Martha doing something like that. So it's one of those where you hope what she's doing massively pays off.
Exactly. And I know that we've talked about it a lot in the past, and that there are still a lot of supremely talented players who could have that stunning moment that inspires someone sitting at home. Look at the likes of Sam Kerr, who will be there. Pretty much the entirety of the US national team is full of talent, and they're also taking their own stance in terms of pay with their governing body as well. So we'll definitely be an interesting one to see play out. Before I draw the specific section to a close, any players you are particularly looking forward to seeing who could fill that role as, I don't know, the social media viral impact, the Caitlin Ohashi of the FIFA World Cup?
I don't know. I don't know if anyone quite has the same level of power. I mean, for me, one of the players you always want to watch is Alex Morgan. Just for what she's achieved in the game, she's brilliant. Sam Kerr, Australia, you know, such an exciting young player. And I think the moments that are going to go viral in this tournament, those moments of insane skill, of which Alex Morgan and Kerr are both more than capable of producing, and the likes of our own Fran Kirby and Beth Mead. Obviously, I'm massively biased towards Beth Mead as a Sunderland fan, having seen her play for Sunderland. But we saw that sort of cross-come shot that went in a friendly, I think it was against Australia. And that went pretty viral. So there's a lot of talent in this tournament. Saki Kumagai as well, the Japanese player. She was on the shortlist of five, I think, for the BBC's Player of the Year. She plays for Lyon, an exceptional talent as well. So another player to look out for. But I couldn't really pick one. I've just named a few.
Just a few. I'll be throwing Nikita Paris in there as well, because the way she's progressed this year, and obviously she's moving on from the Super League as well. Very interesting to see what she does on the international stage as well. But anyway, that draws a close to the first half of this discussion episode. We're going to delve into the participation side of things after this short break.
Follow Sportsbild Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram, or go to our website, sportsbildonline.com.
Now to the participation side, specifically girls' participation. In March, it was revealed that a survey of more than 14,000 women found that almost 40% in the UK and Ireland found that they decreased their amount of physical activity or withdrew from it entirely during puberty. The research from St Mary's University Twickenham said that the equivalent global figure was 25% and only 15% in the USA. But probably even more shocking is this statistic. Just 8% of girls between 11 and 18 are meeting the chief medical officer's recommendation of a daily hour of activity, and that is exactly half the figure for boys, which, as we said before, isn't exactly promising on the boys' side either. But when you look specifically at the girls' side, 8% is stupidly low. So, very general, wide question to start off with. What are we getting so wrong when countries like the USA and other parts of the world seem to get it maybe not perfect, but at least better than what we have at the moment?
I think we're still paying for the legacy of generations before us who just drummed in that message constantly that sport wasn't for women. If you look back to sort of late 19th, early 20th century, the crowds that would turn up for women's hockey matches, women's football matches, were insane, like 50, 60,000 to go and watch England women play. And then all of a sudden we turned around and said, oh no, sport isn't for women, you're not allowed to play, it's damaging your chance of having babies, you deserve a place in the kitchen. Like, what happened in people's views to think that all of a sudden women couldn't play sport? Like, what was it? And things are changing now. There's still a lot of those stereotypes in place, but the younger generation, for ourselves coming through, I know I was brought up in a household where it was very normal for my sister to play sport alongside me. We were a very competitive family, and I went to school with a load of sporty girls. So we're growing up, and this generation and generations below us are bringing about a change. But there's still a lot of those people who have grown up with absolutely no women playing sport, and they're holding it back. And therefore, these are the people who, as we mentioned before, they'll be the trolls on Twitter saying, oh, women's football's boring. And I've seen it plenty of times that people I know of a certain age and people I respect will then come out with a view like this. I'm thinking, you are the exact problem. Like, imagine if you had a daughter and she heard you saying that. But that figure of 8% is really worrying. And it shows that even though we are a generation who are much more accepting of women's sport, there's still a lot of change that needs to happen.
I'm going to take a more general view as well. Something I've been noticing in my line of work, because I've been doing a lot of stories You may have seen on social media about gang crime and gang awareness and things like that. And one of the striking things that I picked up on, having spoken to David Simmons, who is a teacher himself and runs Changing Lives for Harlow Project, or Changing Lives in Harlow Project, where he essentially uses sport to try and give vulnerable children in that area something to latch onto and something to focus on and keep them out of trouble that they may end up finding themselves in without that sporting outlet. I think we both agree that without sport, for us, we would be in very different situations. I definitely wouldn't be doing what I'm doing in terms of career. We definitely wouldn't be doing this podcast, for
starters.
I'd
be very bored.
We wouldn't have met doing the sports course that we did. So just showing how important sport is here. But the point I'm making that David made to me, being a teacher himself, is that the pressure in schools right now is so focused on hitting your targets in English, maths and science, subjects like that, and sport is just pushed to the side because maybe not across the board, but certainly in sub-administrative levels, whether you've got a kid at sport or not doesn't mean a thing. But if you've got X amount of pupils getting A's and A stars at maths, suddenly that makes you look a whole lot better and you're far more secure in your position, in your role as a teacher, a head teacher, whatever it may be at that school. Something I think is mirrored across a lot of the country is that sport is just pushed to the side a lot of the time now, and really we need to see that role reversal come back into play, because while you may have so many kids that are great at English and great at maths, doing something like sport, whether it's team sport or individual sport, can get you so much confidence, can develop your social skills in a way that other subjects can't, and it needs to be have that renewed focus put back on it, because that's ultimately how you get better people and how people deal with the problems of life a lot better, because there's only so much you can learn sitting in the classroom doing fractions when you're sitting at home having to deal with whatever life throws at you.
It's a very weird situation, because my housemate is a PE teacher and he's looking for a new job, and he says it's so difficult in this country to get a job as a PE teacher in a secondary school because there are so many, and yet we're seeing so few children. I mean, this is more primary school level we're talking about here, but we're seeing so few children meeting the recommended targets. And it is such a shame, and it's similar to another great passion of mine is music, and to see subjects like art and music and PE being pushed aside for schools because they want to get more funding and be seen as more successful is such a shame. Obviously, you've got loads of schools out there, my old secondary school included, who pride themselves on being a sporty school. So for them, the impact won't be as great. But yeah, for a school that maybe doesn't have such an established sporting history, that's going to be the first thing to go. And ultimately, not every kid likes sport, but who doesn't like going outside, having a run about with your mates, throwing a ball, catching a ball, just doing something fun? And also, there's a study that came out a couple of weeks ago now as we speak about the break times for children. It's been reduced horrifically across the country, that to the point where a lot of schools aren't having even an hour lunch break now. And that is also, you need this organized, I think they call it organized chaos time or something like that, just to have a runabout with your mates. And you can't do that because there's so much pressure on getting a level 7 in English at GCSE, if that's the right equivalent to what we used to get. It's just everything relies on money, and the focus is being put on the statistics rather than the welfare, and that is really, really worrying.
It's the damaging side of this target-based environment, I think, because if you've got signs that people aren't going to meet those targets and you take away the break time and try and hammer home extra lessons to make sure that they do get those targets. But then the kids that aren't so great at lessons get left on the wayside. The kids who are better at the sporting side of things, the organised chaos side of things, if you like, as well. But it's not just confined to schools either. If you look at the cost of joining sports clubs, the cost of maintaining sports equipment, the cost of hiring out sports halls, taking the fencing side of things, my own sport, into the equation here, and the amount of competitions I saw fold in Scotland, and They're not cheap things to enter as well. If you want to compete, you're probably spending minimum 15, 20 quid to actually enter a competition. And they folded because they couldn't afford the rental prices for the sports halls. That's primarily the reason. So if you've got clubs struggling to afford those fees to hold a training session for 2 hours one night a week, then where else do these kids outside of school actually turn to if they want to do a sport like that, or if they want to do football and they don't have the facilities purely because of cost, whether it's in terms of getting football boots or just having somewhere to go to on a certain night?
For me, the cost of sports like hockey and football, the membership fees are something I struggle to understand why they're so high, because the equipment you actually need is minimal for those sports. For something like cricket, you need a lot of equipment and it's expensive. Being a hockey goalkeeper is different. You need a lot of equipment and that equipment is expensive. But to play hockey, what do you need? You need a stick, a ball, a couple of goals. Obviously, the pitches with the whole water-based scenario, they're quite expensive to hire, so I understand that. But yeah, for a lot of sports, and rugby as well, I don't understand why membership fees are so high. And cheerleading's another one. We pay a lot of money a year to do cheerleading. And essentially, all you need to do is, you just need to turn up. And you need either some crash mats or you need a sprung floor. And I get if you're hiring out a sprung floor, that's expensive. But the prices they charge for competitions are ridiculous. And, you know, in this day and age, more and more, whereas there's more and more financial strain on families, sport is going to become more and more difficult to fund, which is such a shame. And yet prices are still continuing to rise. I don't get it.
And then you're basically putting aside all the kids from families who can't afford that. And then we're supposed to be talking about making environments and sport and professions as diverse and equal as possible. But then when you've got this as the situation, that's very tough to achieve that.
It's also the fact that playing fields are disappearing. People are buying them to build new houses, or schools are building new buildings on them. So the opportunities to actually just have a kickabout are also disappearing, which is such a shame when we've got such a great sporting heritage as a nation. We've got so many kids who genuinely want to be athletes when they grow up, and they're struggling to find those opportunities that for our predecessors, for our parents, our grandparents, were so readily available and so cheap and accessible.
Reminds me of a tweet I think I remember seeing a couple of months ago that went semi-viral, if you like. Think of how many England internationals, Scottish internationals, British Olympians there could have been that have gone under the radar purely because they haven't had the opportunity to try out various different sports at a particular age. When you actually think about how many people that could be, it's quite a scary thought. Just think what might have been for a lot of those people.
A lot of people say if you want something bad enough, you will go out and find a way of doing it. And with a lot of athletes, that is the case. But sometimes it is just a case, like you say, if you don't get the opportunity to try and find something that you will excel at and be an Olympic athlete. I would have loved the opportunity to have had a go at so many more different sports when I was younger. And I had, obviously, a lot of injury issues which would have held me back, but I just felt like there weren't the opportunities that I felt like I could have had. Like, I would have loved to have had a go at fencing, for example. I probably wouldn't have been very good at it, but I would have loved to have tried other things when I was younger. But schools don't offer those opportunities because they have the stereotypical rugby, netball, hockey, football, train, PE teach, and they don't have the opportunity to give children a chance to try something completely new, completely different, a bit wacky, like Quidditch, which I only discovered at university. I never played, but imagine, you know, it's not an Olympic sport, but it's a sport you can represent your country at, and it's difficult. It's just something different.
Turning the conversation back to something a bit more positive, following on from that, and back to football as well. And that was the FA's What If Pledge, which came out, last week now, being that the FA has now promised to make sure every girl has opportunities to play football at school, with a whole number of dedicated schemes that are going to be rolled out across the country. That was the what if pledge made by the FA director of the women's professional game, Kelly Simmons. Big, big move, I think, considering what we've just talked about, because I think we both see in our lines of work and talking to people who are directly involved, that's probably the biggest issue in terms of bringing through the next generation.
I think it's a brilliant pledge. Just giving girls the chance to play football, because stereotypically and historically that's not something they've had much of a chance of. So I just hope the FA is actually able to produce on this, and they're not held back by what we've mentioned before, are a cut in break times, a cut in PE times, and that actually they are given the scope and the opportunity to put this plan into place.
Likewise, that, like you said, I think that's going to be the big thing to see play out, really, as to whether they will be able to roll it out in the way we hope they'll be able to roll it out. And obviously depends on how sponsors get behind it as well, and how well football or schools get behind football too. Bearing in mind then the tournament this summer, do we see that opening a lot of people's eyes, and maybe specifically the people who make those decisions to cut break times or to make sports halls and sport more accessible to young children and girls?
Success breeds success. So naturally, if the Lionesses do well, that will have a major impact on this opportunity.
Likewise, Scotland and the Scottish kids as well, who are
exactly
watching.
Exactly. And the fact that the tournament is so easily accessible on the BBC and on TalkSport is a real positive. I feel like we're going to have no opportunity but to take notice of this tournament, especially if England do well. And it feels like this could be a start of something really special, and not just for football, but for women's sport in this country. This summer feels like it could be the start of something very special, and it starts with this Football World Cup tournament, bounces off straight into the Netball World Cup as well. I just hope that the momentum that hopefully will be generated this summer is something that we can continue to push, and that it doesn't sort of die off, because that's what it felt like a little bit after 2015. There's a massive push initially after finishing third in Canada, and then it felt like it died off a bit. And then we had the Euros, which, as we've discussed previously, was slightly different and didn't quite generate the momentum it wanted. So hopefully this time, the accessibility of the tournament for fans and success for England will bring about a massive change and allow the FA to implement their plans to increase participation levels.
Agreed. Huge opportunity that people have to take. I was going to say the exact same thing as what you said about the 2015 World Cup, but in relation to 2012 and the Olympics. I look at fencing, and fencing's participation numbers soared after the 2012 Olympics, but same thing, it died off, as I'm sure was the case with a whole other number of sports as well after that. It presents a massive opportunity for women's football to really latch onto, but it's about continuing the momentum once the tournament is actually done and dusted. But here's hoping people take full advantage of that tournament, and we'll be sitting here in a year, 2 years, 4 years' time, hopefully with a studio by that point.
That would be the dream.
Talking about how this tournament has been a massive game changer for girls at a grassroots level.
Maybe with one of the Lionesses as well. Who knows?
Potentially. And on that note, we will bring that discussion to an end. In terms of content that we've still got to come up, as you've alluded to, there's a Netball World Cup coming up soon as well, to which we'll be putting out some bits and pieces for that. Before we go, as ever, we'll point you to our social media pages, Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram. All of our handles are SportsBuildPod, so you can go there and keep an eye on all the latest updates regarding our content. We have a lot of written articles coming your way as well, and you can find it all there. Do get involved, do take part, and if you want to let us know your thoughts on anything, you can get in touch at our email address, which is sportsbillpod@gmail.com. Other than that, I think that is pretty much it from us on this special episode. Lots of in-depth chat. I think we were far more serious than we normally are when we're talking about things like that.
We didn't make a mistake. We did not have to stop once.
still got time to muck up something. But yes, do keep an eye on social media. Do keep an eye on our podcast channels and make sure you get subscribing and give us any reviews if you feel that we've done a good job in delivering some World Cup content to you. Here's to a wonderful tournament. Enjoy the summer of sport. And until next time, listeners, we will see you very soon.